It's 5 o'clock. Allowed
to spend any money.
If I wear makeup, he says I look like a whore.
He's made it clear my family isn't welcome.
I used to have friends, but we never even go out anymore.
But at least he's never hit me, right?
Psychological abuse is the root of all abusive relationships, whether there are bruises or not. If you feel helpless and like your voice has been taken, there is help.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.
Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host and co-host Delilah Jones of ImaginePublicity.com, welcoming you this Saturday evening and each and every Saturday evening for another educational, lively, and interesting and entertaining show dealing with the aftermath of crime. And so this is Lady Justice once again greeting you from the great state of South Carolina once more. I feel very fortunate to be here and to offer you yet another diverse guest and topic this evening. And before I bring him in, let me say good evening to Delilah Jones, delightful Delilah. How are you, Delilah?
Hi, Donna. Doing great. Really excited for this guest tonight. I think this is a topic that really needs to be discussed, and hopefully the listeners will get a lot of information out of this so that, you know, we can all be prepared for what's out there in the world today and, you know, hopefully find some solutions to this.
I agree, because I think that this is a topic that very few people discuss, and I'm very proud to be introducing it. So with that, let me bring in our esteemed guest, Timothy Dimoff is with SAC Consulting, and as a matter of fact, he's from Akron, Ohio, and has upwards of 3 websites, so he's a very busy guy. He has many many areas of expertise in which he's a sought-after speaker, a trainer, an investigator, an expert legal witness. He is a consultant to law enforcement and the media. He is also an author of 4 books, and he is nationally recognized expert on violent behavior and criminal investigation, and has provided commentary on a number of shows dealing with crime. But and that's such a vast area of topics to get into. So unfortunately, we have to narrow our focus for purposes of 1 hour. But I think what we are going to get into this evening, as I say, is something that really is a little bit nebulous in terms of the definition. And Tim wrote a book specifically on this, and I think it deals with many, many aspects of life these days. And we're going to be talking about life rage. So with that, I'll say good evening, Tim, and thank you so much for being on Shattered Lives. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me, Don. I appreciate it. I'm very excited.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you. And to know that our life sometimes virtually is spinning out of control with due to all of the forces that we deal with these days. I mean, I'm a baby boomer, and growing up in the 50s and 60s, life was a lot simpler, wasn't it, Tim, as compared to what it is now?
Yeah, it was. You know, what we've had is you go back to the 50s, you know, rock and roll and all that, and people got along much better in the 50s than that. I mean, if you really go back to our grandparents and their grandparents, we were at a time in this country where there weren't locks on the doors. I mean, think about 50 years ago, no locks on the door, no concern about really security to your home and that. People knew each other. They felt comfortable around each other. And slowly that changed with aggressive behavior and violence and up to the point where we are right now.
Yeah, and it just seems like every aspect of our life, we're touched by some type of aggressive behavior or violence. And I know that your company specializes in this aspect that we're going to get into. But so maybe you want to tell us what exactly you specialize in, what your company does, and let's talk about what life rage is. What does it encompass? Some examples, some tips, and maybe what we can do about it to begin with.
Okay. As a quick summary, my company deals with human resource issues and security issues, but our focus is really on aggressive behavior and violent behavior. You know, we help companies with more of the volatile topics like workplace violence and bullying and internal issues and that. You know, we have a full-fledged investigation company, division, and we have a security division. So basically, we go out there to schools, churches, and businesses, and we look at their security posture. We do a total review of everything from locks, doors, windows, processes, everything and everybody that comes in and out of that building. And we take a 10,000-foot look, and we say, hey, here's your strengths, here's your weaknesses, and here's some short-term and long-term recommendations. And we really help those people and businesses and entities. And now we're just inundated across the country to look at these schools and churches and the businesses and help them reduce their criminal behavior that happens to them. Active shooting, we're one of the top recognized organizations on these active shootings. And we've done research on over 300 shootings that have happened. We have some of the most extensive research. So we are looking at what are the trends and how can we prevent and reduce those trends. And overall, we're looking at aggressive behavior of people. What is causing all this aggression? And it's all wrapped up and now has come full circle that it used to be like road rage was by itself, but now we have rage everywhere. We have rage when we go to the store, when we're driving, when we get on an airplane, when we're buying flowers, when we're going here. And it's elevated now to not specific rage, but really all aspects of life. Thus, the book Life Rage has been created because it's across everything. And what we decided to do is become really the experts or authorities in this rage and violence and really look into what it is, where it's going, but more importantly, how can we prevent it and actually reduce it and start to cause a change to get rid of rage and violence in everybody's life?
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the change in our society in that, between the 50s and the 60s and now? It used to be that maybe when you reported to your company, well, we've got these tried and true methods of conflict resolution, and you use these methods, and thereby you solve this problem so it doesn't escalate up the chain to rage. What is it? What are the forces that contributed to us just having, you know, a problem in the workplace or, you know, whatever public arena to escalate up to this level of aggression?
Well, there's been several things that we've been able to identify that is happening. I'll mention a few, and you can kind of decide what direction you want to go in here.
Sure.
But let's start within the home. A breakdown of the basic structure in the home. Parents, kids, discipline, love, kids having specific duties in the home and following through in that. We, unfortunately, have seen a breakdown in the parent responsibility to the kid and the kids responding to the parents, i.e. respect for parents, and the parents creating a structure. There used to be a stronger structure in the home for things that need to be done in that. So we have seen a breakdown in the home. Secondly, mm-hmm. we've seen an intimidation come into the schools where now teachers and administrators are intimidated to take action to kids or students that are not, you know, evolving in, you know, in a positive or disciplined direction. We're seeing a lot more mental health issues in general in society, and those mental health issues are really not being addressed strongly. We're seeing mm-hmm. consequences on the legal end where criminals, you know, the repercussions to criminals has decreased, and we're seeing a breakdown in the structure in some of our businesses and entities. And here's the overall theme, and it took me 8 years after researching and writing my book, Life Rage, it took me 8 years. People would say, well, what's the bottom line? What's the number one thing that's really affecting Life Rage? And mm-hmm. this is it. There is no fear of consequences in this country, for the most part, of people's negative action. There used to be 50 years ago, 20 years ago, a much more, and I use the word fear, and I should use the word belief. There is no belief in the majority of cases, from children to criminals to whoever, that there's going to be any kind of real consequence to their negative action. And that's really where I tie the core of this problem. So that's really where the bottom foundation has fallen out.
And, mm-hmm. you know, Tim, where do you think that this root of this is coming from? I see it in, you know, in our judicial system, especially when you're trying to prosecute cases and prosecutors don't really want to prosecute unless they know they have a winnable case. And so, therefore, they're so much more likely to go with a plea deal. So then this criminal, like you say, there are no real negative consequences to the actions that they perpetrate.
Right.
You agree?
Yeah. You know, I hate to say it, but I'll just give you an example. You know, we had somebody in our area murder somebody and get 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, where?
Oh, that's typical.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't comprehend. You take another person's life intentionally, not accidentally, intentionally, and you're getting 7 years. 20 years ago, that was a life sentence, if not 30 years. Today, it's a slap on the hand. And criminals know that. And when we repeat those actions, both in our legal and our other areas, we are encouraging people that, hey, you can get away with this and that. You know, we have extended our boundaries way beyond where they should be. And as human beings, psychologically, the bottom line is human beings will do what they do based on the belief of a consequence and the strength of that consequence. And we've lost that.
Mm-hmm. So those that are brought up in a home that still has structure and family support and whatnot maybe has a better sense of right and wrong and that there would be consequences and you follow the law, whereas maybe another family would not, or is it that the pendulum is swinging so far to the other end of the side? Like we're seeing where when we talk with our colleague Jennifer Bishop Jenkins with regard to juvenile offenders, and the affluent families seemingly have everything, you know, they could want, and oh, we just did this out of boredom to see if we could get away with it. So it's not a matter of the haves and the have-nots, right? Part of the equation, right? I mean, it's hard to understand. Where is it? So the criminal justice system is getting clogged and overburdened with all of these case after case after case. So here it is, and they can't address the need, and they're understaffed. And then, you know, the parental, the family unit is deteriorating or almost non-existent. The workplace is wreaking havoc. You know, people just go in and shoot, you know. And I don't know. Is there one particular system that we need to address in some kind of a hierarchical order, Tim? How do we address this in terms of the remedy?
Well, we start with the teaching of responsibility and the teaching of consequences. And obviously, yep, we need a contribution from the parents. Whether you are rich or poor, mm-hmm. doesn't matter. It's how your parents make you responsible for what little you have or what lot you have. And it's not
right.
a matter of how much you have. It's a matter of how you are brought up, trained, and raised to respect whatever you have. And you learn to earn those things that you want. And you learn that there's a consequence for deviating from the proper path. I mean, it's all around structure. If you want to mm-hmm. show an extreme, take the gangs. I've interviewed over 500 gang members, and kids join gangs because they're looking for structure and discipline because they're not getting it in the home. And in a gang, there is a strict consequence to deviating, and they have more dedication to their family than the gang members do to their real families, as a great example.
So their structure and discipline, even though it may be very deviant and whatnot, that's what they're craving, and they don't get it in their own family. Wow, that's incredible. Now, are you saying that we need to start this from the kindergarten level, maybe?
I'm saying we need to start it from the home. Your kid wakes up in the morning, they need to know they need to make their bed before they come out of the bedroom. When they're done playing with their toys, they need to know they got a responsibility to put them away. They need to understand that there are things they need to do around that house to help mom and dad and brothers and sisters take care of that house. There needs to be an understanding that that is not an option. Kids have too many options without consequences. It starts in the home. Then the schools can pick up from there and continue that discipline structure mm-hmm. and consequences. And then they can come to work and I can continue. But I will guarantee you, if a kid doesn't learn to make his bed and put his toys away and to be responsible in his own home, I can't make him into a good, responsible worker. He or she is already on the wrong track.
Right. And, one refrain that we constantly hear is, you know, from departments of education, because I work for state government, and with respect to teaching, the constant complaint is that they're having to be a replacement for parents because they're just not getting that. And they're supposed to be supplemental versus replacing parent responsibilities. And, you know, they're going hungry. They don't have breakfast in the morning. They don't have this. They don't have that. Given those situations, I mean, I don't know. How can we make parents of children who are not responsible suddenly turn around and be responsible such that those children would change their path in life? I mean, can we do that, or is it too late by a certain age, Tim?
Well, a lot of people would argue with you that it's really tough. I mean, try to change a high school kid's attitude towards anything, and people
uh-huh.
will tell you've got a tough road. One thing we know for sure, we can
yeah.
make a huge difference in the lower grades with programs and structured programs, grade school especially. That is where we still have a chance to change or influence the kids. So much of the research says let's get them at a much earlier age and focus there, because we can bring certain things in. You look at the DARE program across the country. It's been very successful, but the DARE program is targeted towards grade school kids, not towards high school kids, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other responsible type programs that they're instituting in grade school. So if we had to pick somewhere where we get our best effort for our money and time, it has to be in the earlier stages of grade school is where we can get a lot of influence, and we can make change. Kids are open at that age, and they'll listen and respect these heroes, these new heroes in their life called their teachers, and their teachers are taking or representing the same kind of caliber as their parents. So right there, we have a chance to influence and change them in a positive direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see where, you know, in theory that should work, and I'm hoping that, you know, various school systems and states across the country are saying, well, we're strapped for funds. If we have to pick, and again, I'm being devil's advocate here, we have to pick between, you know, this sports coach and paying for this self-esteem program, which one is it going to be? I mean, this is so important with the advent of all of these school shootings. Are you beginning to see, like, within the last couple of years, the whole tenor of what schools feel are important in workplace environments, corporations? Are you seeing a change in their attitude with respect to their priorities and where they want to place their money?
Well, absolutely, because there's less money. You know, there's not more money today. There's less money. You know, look at
right.
the economy, the taxes, the amount of money. Everybody's fighting for pennies, nickels, and dimes. And, yes, we've got to at least prioritize where can we get our best results for the money that we have. And, of course, it is in the lower grades as far as results go, you know. You know, we've proven time and time again, programs in the grade schools are much more effective than programs in, say, high school to try to change behavior. It's human nature. And let me just say this, 80% of a child's future attitude towards sex, drugs, work, teamwork, work ethic, you name it, 80% of that formed attitude and habit, 80% is derived and registered and learned before the age of 8 to 10. So that tells
mm-hmm.
us we've got to get them before the age of 10 or we have a uphill battle.
Wow.
Well, and
yeah.
I think, too, it becomes the responsibility of the adults, whether it be the, you know, the adults in the family, the adults in school, all the adults that these children come in contact with have to recognize that this is their responsibility as well. I mean, everyone has to work together to solve this problem, and if the first thing they have to do is recognize it and be willing to do something about it, and I think that's one area where we see a lot of disconnect.
Right.
Yeah, and I think, though, too, if you approach adults or parents when their kids are in grade school and you send home something that says, we're working today or this week on self-esteem, we're working on responsibility, here's what we're doing at school. We would like you to engage conversation with your kids. We would like you to incorporate something in the home that
yeah.
would mirror image
Carry
this.
Over.
But
mm-hmm.
we'll get parents, and not all of them, but a lot of them, if they see the schools leading the charge, especially with their younger kids,
yeah.
and we send something home and we make them aware of it and we say, please, you know, see if you can engage and complement what we're doing. We can get a lot of buy-in from parents. But if you send something home from a high school and says, we got your kid talking today about, I don't know, team or work ethics, parents are going to say, look, my kid's a teenager. You know, they're almost an adult. That's up to them, you know. We don't get the
mm-hmm.
buy-in like we do from the grade school when the kids are little.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. You know, kind of segueing into a little bit of a different area, I know when I first looked at your material, you know, part of your consulting business is, you know, we put you back in control of your business. And with regard to, you know, since I've been in the work environment in different careers, I was in healthcare for many, many years. I'm in state government now. And it's all the same in some respects in terms of you know, the bureaucracy you encounter, the diversity of people. You've got the worker bees. You've got the people that are the slugs that don't do anything. You've got the troublemakers. You've got everything. With respect to that kind of environment, and you being an adult and you're way beyond that point of turning somebody around, I find it very interesting that, you know, you're talking about, say you have a good worker, such as me, and you might want to promote them to a manager, Tim, but there seems, Delilah was just mentioning the term disconnect. Invariably, and this goes on in state government all the time, okay, you take this test, you fill in the box, you get a score, you're suddenly a manager. But does that qualify you to be a manager? And from the information I've read, it doesn't. Can we talk a little bit about that and how that feeds into animosity and builds up to workplace violence? Because I've written some very extensive blogs with regard to workplace violence. It's a very interesting topic to me. So can we get into that a little bit?
Sure. There's a lot there, and let me just say a couple things. First
sure.
thing is, in relation to your managers, typical companies take some of their best workers and they promote them to their worst managers. And I'm going to say it again. We take that typical good worker, that 150 mile an hour, that extra person that gives the extra, and we promote them to our worst manager. And the reason we do that is we assume that because they're a great worker, hardworking, that they're going to be a great manager. And we don't give them the additional training that they need to have to be a manager, such as personal skills, communication, workplace violence, bullying, harassment. They need to understand the legal stuff of that. They need to understand how to recognize that. They need to understand how to respond to that, to solve those problems, to investigate those, to confront them. We take a good worker and we think he's automatically or she's automatically going to be a great worker. We need to train them. We need to give them more tools. So first thing my company does at Sachs Consulting is we focus on showing companies how you build a positive culture, and you build it by promoting good people and giving them the tools to make sure that they complement the workforce and can deal with all these issues that exist today. If you do that alone, you can change a company culture in a very positive way. The other quick thing I'll say is you don't let the one bad apple spoil the whole bunch. And by that I mean way too many companies, the majority of their workers are always good workers, always dedicated. But there's always a bad apple that dictates the entire workplace culture or a certain division or a certain shift. And we let that bad apple just turn into cancer instead of addressing the issue of bad worker and not letting the bad worker get away with it. What are we talking about again? Consequences to not being a good worker, but we fail to act on that, and it's usually one or two in the whole building, and we let them dictate the culture, which is going in the wrong direction. So there's your two main issues.
Well, this is my comment to that. I can totally relate to that situation because there are a couple of bad apples invariably in everyone's workplace. But as an example of, with me working for state government, our state has very, very strong unions, and in fact, probably the strongest in the nation. And it's only a slight exaggeration to say that invariably those bad apples can get away with anything. You almost have to commit homicide before you are fired from state government. And I mean that seriously. And they just get passed along or transferred to another agency or whatnot. And, you know, that just is not right. How do you, if unions have a stranglehold like that with regard to, oh, well, here are your rights, and so they did this, and, you know, we've negotiated that. How do you get those bad apples out of there, Tim?
Well, that's a great question. And I've dealt with unions and strong unions across the United States and helped companies with this exact issue, that scenario that you've given. Even in strong unions, even in non-union, strong union, whatever, there is a discipline procedure. And that discipline procedure may be mundane as detailed and said, you know, first time they get verbal warning, second time they get a second warning, third time they get 3 days off, fourth time they get 2 weeks off, fifth time they're finally terminated. What we fail to do even in those strong environments, is learn the discipline procedure. And most discipline procedures are observation, documentation, confrontation, and use the discipline procedure that's in a strong union environment. Yes, you're going to go through four or five levels before you get to obvious termination. But I will guarantee you, in most of those cases, the managers will say, the hell with it, it ain't worth it, it's too much trouble. And I say, no, whatever the system is, union, non-union, whether it's two levels or five levels of discipline, learn that discipline procedure and use it to the T and use it against the bad apples. We fail to want to put the time and effort in to go through those headaches, but if you do, you can, in the long run, make a difference and stop the bad apples.
And is this supposed to happen fairly quickly? I mean, at certain points in the discipline procedure, you know, they will invariably, if there's some kind of crime committed, they will call in the state police. But, I mean, does it have to get to that very extreme level before you do something really proactive?
No, it doesn't. If it gets to a criminal level, that's easy, because that's called the shortcut, because if it's a criminal action, it's out of the hands of the union, and the union doesn't have any bearing on a criminal case, because the police come in and say, hey, look, there's a major theft, he's going to jail, boom, boom, boom. But if it's not a criminal, you got to go through the discipline procedures that union management has created. The problem, again, is it's much more complicated, and yes, it might take a year and a half and several violations before that person gets to that level where the union says, well, we got you off the first two, three times. We can't get you off of this. You're terminated. There's nothing we can do. And it will get to that point, but someone's got to be willing to put the time into that documentation history and do it. In most cases, managers get frustrated and they say, to heck with it. And so they stop at the second or third level, and they were really only one or two more incidences or places away from eliminating that bad apple. Hey, and I feel for them. I understand it's almost ridiculous what is required. But my point is, ridiculous or not, the system still exists. It may be more complicated. It may take more time. But even in the unions, there's a process. In the end, if you go through the whole process, where they can be eliminated, disciplined, or they change because they understand there's a consequence, and that consequence is they're real close to losing their job.
Mm-hmm. You mean the manager or the employee or both?
The employee.
I mean, what if the manager doesn't follow through? Is there a consequence for the manager?
Well, there's where the other problem is. Is there really a consequence, you know? Another weakness,
right.
You know, another weak spoke in the wheel, you know?
Yeah. Well, what I wonder, too, is that in that process, if they haven't gone to that, you know, set fourth and fifth level where they could have gotten that person out that's poisoning the well, so to speak, is that where the rage comes in, and then that, you know, so that employee, bad apple, boils over, goes in and shoots up the place, and you got people killed if for not them following through? Or is there, in all the workplace violence things that I can think of, and even in my own state, is there a common denominator, Tim, where you say, this is the point where they could have made the difference between life and death, and this is the common place where things break down? Or is it very individual?
Well, there's a couple things, but the research we've done on aggressive behavior, violence, and let's take active shooters right now. Let's talk about them, and there's other categories of people, but the general public is very fascinated with the active shooters. Why are we seeing more active shootings, you know, in the last 10, 12 years? And a couple things come into play. Number one, in answer to your question, the common denominator of many of the active shooters, and a lot of people say, well, there really is no common denominator. The common denominator that we have seen, and we have some of the most extensive research in the country, is that many times the active shooter either has gone through some sort of mental, and I should say emotional, type of situation where they have become depressed, disgruntled, unhappy, etc. So our common denominator in our research says, no, it's people that have gone through an emotional type of situation. It can be a mental illness, or it can be just an emotional letdown in life where they're very discouraged. And we see that as a very common denominator, whether it's a child or whether it's an adult. We have not seen a shooter that was a happy-go-lucky and life was great. They are down on their luck. The second thing...
Why are they so good at hiding it, too? I mean, is there something... Or are they good, or is it just that we don't pay attention?
Well, I would say in very, very few cases are they hiding it. In these research that we've done, we have gone back, the police have gone back, and all of a sudden, you got family, friends saying, oh, yeah, they mentioned that they were being bullied in school, and one day they were going to get revenge, and they were mentioning this and that. It's amazing after it happens how many people come out of the woodwork, family, friends, neighbors, and say, yeah, he was acting weird. Yeah, he was depressed. Yeah, he was, you know, brokenhearted over this. So we don't believe in the majority of cases that it is a secret at all. We believe people have been ignoring it, and they just don't think it won't happen here, whereas now we're starting to believe it can happen anywhere.
Well, if any good can come out of it, then we're trying to raise the awareness then, at least at that basic level, that it can happen anywhere.
We have to really understand that today, and I think we finally are starting to get there, where businesses and churches and schools and everybody is starting to say, you know what, it can happen in my business, small, medium, or large. It can happen in my church, in my school. Why? Because we now have the historical data and the research that says it can happen anywhere, and here are our indicators, and here's what we've got. We have switched to not here or not my place to, oh, my God, it might just happen here, or I can see it happening here. So that is good that we no longer block it out and we understand that it can happen anywhere and start to look for red flags.
Right, and I'm sorry, I interrupted your second point that you were going to make with regard to the active shooter.
Okay.
Yeah,
the other point I was going to make about the active shooter is that the 24/7 days a week press coverage of shooters basically is, without a doubt, in my personal research and opinion, the media, and they don't do it intentionally, but the media has glorified the shooters and has glorified aggressive behavior. And someone that is depressed, someone that is emotionally upset, when they see these other shooters come out and shoot and kill and wound all these people and kids, the next shooter is starting to be developed even further. The glorification of us glorifying aggressive behavior or abnormal behavior and, in fact, the shootings is only causing more to happen. We're making heroes and we're making celebrities out of these shooters. Anybody that has an emotional problem looks at that news coverage as that person becomes a celebrity in their life, and they want to mimic and copy them. And we know that because the diaries that are recovered from these shooters in these shootings that kill themselves or the police shoot them, they are saying they admire the previous shooters, and they want to be just like them before they die. So we know this is a fact.
Well, what happened to, you know, Superman and those kinds of heroes? Are they just so passe that, I mean, I don't know.
Well, I think, Tim made a very good point in the fact that the media has to take some accountability for a lot of this. And, I'm happy to say that I've seen a lot of commentators who have backed off. They're backing off and they're backing away from appearing on these so-called news programs as just adding fuel to the fire, and they're realizing that. So they're turning down. I'm seeing a lot of people turning down those guest appearances now. And I'm happy for it. I really am, because I totally agree. I think they blow things completely out of proportion. They go over and over and over the same story, the same details, until you go crazy just watching.
Ad nauseam. Right,
a sane person goes crazy just watching it. So, you know, anyone that has some sort of a mental disorder, I can see, you know, definitely how it could affect them.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Delilah, you bring up a great point, and people say, okay, well, what are you going to do about it, Tim? The news media can't stop reporting this. And I said, you know what?
No.
Who says we have to put the shooter's picture on the news?
Mm-hmm.
Who says we have to even say their name? Why can't we
mm-hmm.
say the shooter at Sandy Hook, whose name and picture we're not revealing? This is what their background is about. They were depressed about this. They had a rough childhood. They did this and that. This shooter that we're not going to show the picture and name, he or she did this, this, and this. We can still provide the facts of the case, but the fact that we put the picture and name there, that's the glue that
mm-hmm.
incentivizes the next shooter. I want my picture and name up there 5,000 times a day in the paper, in the magazines. We could stop that and still report the facts.
Well,
I totally agree.
And, you know, there again, I work with some of the people who actually are contacted for these segments on major news programs, and I'm happy to say that a lot of them are saying no. I'm not going to glorify the criminals anymore. We're not going to talk about it. You know, if you want to call me in on a different type of a case, or you know, however this conversation is going to go, it's going to be dictated by the people who are being called upon to give their opinions, and that's all they really are, is just opinions based on their experiences or their education. You know, and the same thing goes with bloggers and anyone who writes articles for a lot of internet places like Huffington Post and places like that. We've got to do something about bringing the news about the victim. The victim has no voice any longer. They should be the center of the news, the center of the article. They should have our compassion, and our sympathies should go out to those families and not so much the perpetrators and the criminals. It's crazy.
Right. And I have to say that I think, and I don't know if this is good or bad, but with the Newtown Sandy Hook shooting, the fact there were so many little vulnerable children, that is a new low in crime with respect to these little innocent children, and how could anyone in their right, well, no one in their right mind could do it. But the fact that there were a couple of adults, yes, but little children, that just, you know, is so intolerant to people in society that I think, and the fact that it was in my home state, that just is the end-all, beat-all, and it woke people up across the nation that, yes, this can happen in my little town. And, you know, to stoop so low is to massacre little children. What could be worse, Delilah? What could be worse? You know, so when it comes to little children, I just don't know. But I totally agree with you with regard to the media having to have a sense of responsibility. And maybe, you know, I was just thinking the other day, CNN has been, or, you know, these 24/7 media, it's been going on at least, 20, 30 years when they, you know, Walter Cronkite started out with 30-minute news. When did it go to 24/7? That was the beginning of the downfall, perhaps. Tim, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with the 24/7. I have a problem with that the less news is talked about and more celebrity status glorification is done. Two shootings made a huge impact in the United States. Columbine was the first one. That woke us up and started the trend. All the ones after that, Paducah, Kentucky, different city schools, the Navy Yard, you name it. But the next one that made an impact and changes was Sandy Hook. And I'm going to tell you why Sandy Hook was such an impact. Because you said they killed our children. Well, they didn't kill our children. I'm going to tell you what they did, what happened there. He killed our babies. And that's why Sandy Hook made a difference. Those weren't little kids. They were looked at as those are our babies. Those are our young little guys and girls. And that, when that happened, my switchboard lit up bigger than anything in the last 8 years for commentary with the news, with guidance. I had, my company had schools, churches, businesses. Everybody was calling and saying, after Sandy Hook, I believe now we've got to do something different here. And the glorification of that shooter at Sandy Hook, I started to see newscasts say, we're not going to show his picture. We're not posting it no more. Mm-hmm. It would be tremendous. I told the news media, if I could get the news media to quit putting pictures and names up, we could cut and reduce next year shootings by 70% in this country. And let me give you one last example. In Japan, it is illegal to put a picture, name, even a story about any juvenile involved in any major crime, including shootings, whatever, in the, any format of a news media in Japan. Japan does not have any form of active shooters going on. None. Zero. Theirs is by law. And it shows me a great example. But this glorification of the shooters, and one other thing, it's not just a glorification of shooters. You get a singer that comes out and creates a song about killing cops, killing women, abusing anything, you know, profanity. You bring these songs out, just simple things. You bring videos out that show blowing people's heads off and arms and legs and getting extra points and bells and whistles and bonus points. The news media jumps all over that, glorifies it, and then it takes off and becomes a rage. Then every show in America wants to have that singer on that's singing this, what I call crap, and they glorify them. And that's called abnormal behavior. So not only are we glorifying and making celebrities out of shooters, we are giving more attention to abnormal behavior than deserves to be. So I'll stop there.
No, that you're entirely right about that. And let's see, we've got about 12 minutes or so to our show. There's a lot of other things we could cover. I'm wondering. I remember reading about you had on your website some tips, general practical tips to eliminate life rage. But if you want to speak to that, that would be wonderful. But another thing I wonder about is, you know, one thing is. You say that we need to plan for every conceivable situation. Is there something in general you can say with respect to how do we plan for every conceivable situation, whether we're talking about our workplace, our home, our church, our school, or whatever? Are there general principles that we can plan for? I mean, are there certain rules that we can take away from this?
Sure.
How do we do that, Tim?
Well, first thing, let me plant the seed in your listeners' minds.
Okay.
Here's a thing that I'm really pushing nationally that people are understanding that tells them what we're at. And the bottom line is this. I need everybody in this country to realize that security and safety – for each of us individually, for our families. Security and safety is no longer a spectator sport. It is definitely no longer a spectator sport. By that I meant 20 years ago and further back, the police were very able to pretty much control neighborhoods, downtown, cities, crime, everything, and they were able to be our security blanket. But not today. We all individually must participate in our own security. The police will do everything they can to help. It is no longer that secure. So, in answer to your question, anytime you are out of your home, going anywhere, you have to start thinking about what would I do if I ran into a problem. You go to a sporting event, to anything, you have to be thinking, what will I do if something bad happens here? You have to be talking to your kids, okay, if we're at this ball game and a bomb goes off or something happens and we get split up, where are we going to meet at? Well, when you're walking to that stadium, you got to stop and show your kids, this is where we're going to meet at if we get split up. We no longer can sit back and think other entities are going to take care of our security or do our planning. No, we have to incorporate our personal security and our family security in every day of what we're doing. We are responsible for that. When I do active shooter training, I just did one 2 days ago, and I told the teachers, the police are not the first responders to an active shooter in your school building. You are. That shooter is already in the building. You are the first responders. How you react protects you and your kids in your classroom. Not how the police react. Now, how you react in delaying, stopping, or preventing that shooter from getting to you and allowing the police to eventually get there very quickly, then the police become the secondary response, but you are the primary. So it's that kind of thinking that we need to happen.
Yeah, and isn't that a sad commentary that we've come to that and we have to do that? But, you know, I have to say, as a homicide survivor, that has been in my mind since my dad was murdered 32 years ago. That is always in the back of my mind because of that vulnerability that we have to live with. But for those people out there who are listening, who are not victims of crime, it's a new cognizance for them. It's not new for those of us who are a crime victim. We're already thinking on that plane, Tim. So, you know, you have to tell those people, you have to become as if you are a crime victim and think like a crime victim. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying exactly. And let me just say a simple vision here. You're walking to your car in a parking deck. Do you really think the police are going to dictate whether you survive that walk to that parking deck, or do you think it's up to you to make sure you do the smart things? Because parking decks are scary, and people get it. You're going to your car. The police are not patrolling the parking deck. Security is there. Cameras are there at certain parts. But the bottom line is how you do that, how you select where you park, how you walk back and forth to that car. Are you looking around, et cetera, et cetera? Are you walking alone or with someone else? I can go on and on and on, but it's a simple example that you are in control of your safety and your destiny, not the police. Now, will they respond and do everything they can? Absolutely they will, but there ain't enough of them to cover everybody.
Yeah, that is for sure. Can you tell us some about the content of your book? I mean, I had heard from talking to you the other day also that you might have another one coming out. What can readers expect when they read your book? And, of course, we want you to give your contact information and where people can get the book as well.
Yeah, you know, the book just stresses that rage and violence is no longer in spots in only certain areas. It says it's in our daily life. And in the book, I explain where it is in our daily lives and the trends and the changes that have happened in the last 10, 20 years. And then the last chapter, which we don't have time to get into, I offer some basic tips. What can we do as individuals, as parents, as people, to make a difference in changing our kids and ourselves and those around us, and how can we help get out of this life rage focus more into a more humanistic, more loving, more safe environment. And the new book coming out, which it's a good year or so away, is just really going to get more into the aggressive behavior and the active shootings and some of more of the recent trends that are there, and just sort of an update on the first book. But, you know, the bottom line is the rage and violence has turned into a daily life experience, and it's no longer once in a while. And the other thing is it's emphasizing it can happen, you know, to anybody, anywhere. And once again, security and safety is no longer a spectator sport. And that's really what we want to emphasize. But anybody that wants the book, just go to sacs.com saxconsulting.com, and you can order it right from our website. That's saxconsulting.com.
Mm-hmm. Well, would you mind if I just read off a couple of the tips from your blog that you had there? Because people, you know, might take these and say, hey, I want to learn more. A couple of the ones that I wrote down, take the TVs out of your kids' bedroom. There needs to be interaction. People need to eat dinner together, take out their computers, work on children's self-esteem. And, you know, every day you need to find the goodness in people and say thank you. You need to focus on positive versus negatives. You need to find the true character of people, what you do when no one is watching. Bring back religion. And one that we always say, Delilah, don't ever give up, right?
Absolutely.
Those are right, and those are some of the very, I mean, very basic things that you think are common sense but are very lacking in our society. And I'm glad to say that I think in nearly 100% of those, I try to live by those principles, and it is so important. You know, I'm just wondering, what is the typical scenario, other than schools and churches approaching you, Tim, what is the bulk of your business these days? Who's calling upon you, and for which aspect of your expertise are they calling upon right now? The active shooter, yes, but what else are you focusing on?
Well, I think the couple areas that are really hot and heavy, obviously, is the management training on dealing with violence, bullying, but how to communicate, how to discipline, how to observe, really how to manage and communicate with your workers and your management. A lot of management training requests. Secondly, physical security assessments, the physical security of the venue, whether it's a church, a school, you know, or a business. And then the third area, ironically, is helping managers and employees learn how to build a positive culture and how to communicate better with each other. Electronics is killing our ability to communicate verbally with each other, and I already have it in some of my solutions that you just rattled off about LifeRange, but I just want to emphasize one thing.
Please
get your kids to interact verbally a lot more today instead of everything being texting and that. It amazes me, kids sit next to each other on buses and restaurants, and they don't talk. They text each other who are sitting right next to them or across from them.
Right.
We desperately need to teach communication and verbal skills. We're losing it really fast with our younger generation, and that reflects and causes other problems that we talked about for the last hour.
Yes, I totally agree with you. And, you know, parents listening to this are probably saying, yeah, easier said than done. But you have to start. You have to try, or you have to limit it and then maybe eliminate from there. And I just want to say it's been a very illuminating hour. Tim, we have to stay in touch. We'd like to work with you on some other project, perhaps bring you back, because this is such a broad topic. It's very important, isn't it, Delilah?
Yeah, it absolutely is, and I know we've only touched the tip of the iceberg.
Yes, we have, but very important topic, and Tim, we will stay in touch with you. Everyone, please go to www.donagore.com and imaginepublicity.com for more information regarding this, and we will have a detailed blog for you, and this show will be in the archives for repeated listening. And please do stay tuned for another show next week, and we look forward to it. Thank you so much, Tim, and we'll talk to you off air. Thank you, Delilah. Everyone be safe and have a good evening.
Thank you, Donna.
You're welcome.